It's probably cold by now. God damn it, he murmured. He checked his watch again. He had been in the hallway for more than 10 minutes, trapped between and waiting and breathing stale air. Sweat slicked his forehead as it poured out of his hair. Adrenaline and cocaine and liquor scoured the walls of his veins. He was ready to explode. Say my name, George. Let me prove I am real.
Thank you, ladies, Wetland said from his post on stage.
Their trays empty, the women left through the door they entered. Audible chagrin rang out as they went.
Don't worry, we'll be seeing more of them later. Lots more. But now, sit. Sit, you animals. Good Lord, y'all act like you've never seen a titty before.
I haven't,
shouted a man in his thick glasses, a telescoping cane laid across his lap.
Good point, Bo. When they come back, you're first in line for a lap dance. Read 'em like Braille, Bo,
hollered someone, and the blind man pantomimed tuning a radio as the other men laughed. George Wetland smoothed the front of his shirt and coughed into his hand as if he had found this crudeness tedious.
Okay, okay. Until then, as I was saying, it's time for some comedy.
At the word, Billy Ray's ears perked like a dog. Unconsciously, his spine straightened. He rolled his neck out once more and flexed his hands, looking and feeling like a boxer behind the curtain.
My esteemed brothers, Wetland said, filling his voice with pomp, it is my humble honor to welcome to the Templar Shiners a man who I've had the pleasure of seeing before on my very own honeymoon those many eons ago. A man who needs no introduction, but he's getting one anyways. Please join me in welcoming a legendary comedian. He sat on the couch next to Johnny Carson. Here he is,
Wetland motioned to the curtain, genuine in his excitement.
Billy Ray Schaefer!
His name is Burden. Billy Ray breathed in, breathed out, and pushed open the door, crossing the space between the door and the microphone, as well as the infinite space in his head. The space between who he was and who he had been. He stared out at the group of drunk men slapping their thick palms together in welcome. Their faces disappeared. Unbeknownst to them, in the moment he removed the microphone from the stand, they were no longer individuals. They were unified, combined. In his presence, they were reborn, melted down into a single organism. The crowd, the faceless beast with the countless mouths, its 100 eyes pregnant with expectation. Feeding time, you monster. I hope you gorge till you choke.
Thanks, George, for the warm welcome.
He adjusted the mic stand to the appropriate height, an act of muscle memory as preconceived as his next breath.
Let's hear it for the girls. I hope to see them later, sitting on Tommy's face.
The men seated nearest Tommy prodded him with their elbows. A hand from behind him tousled his hair.
Now that's my idea of a wedding veil.
He bent towards the blind man.
I bet you'd like to see that, eh, Bo? Hell, I'd bet you'd like to see anything.
The blind man nodded vigorously, shaking the sunglasses off his face into his lap.
What happened, Bo? They make you valet your dog?
Bo may be blind, but I heard his dick can read lips. It telescopes, too. He doesn't even need that cane. Rolling his eyes back into his head, Billy Ray lifted the mic stand to crotch level and tapped it as he crossed to the far side of the stage, then back, milking the crowd's propulsive laughter, and back once more.
Somebody tell Bo what we're laughing about.
It was like waking up. For the next 43 minutes, Billy Ray's voice was the blood in their veins. Reality cooked away. He was their shepherd. They went where he led. Bewitched, they spoke in tongues, laughter, the worldless language of purest communication, the unnatural coupling of logic and primality. Billy Ray explored the space, riffing on what he saw. He chewed up the stage like something uncorralled, pushing, pulling, establishing limits before crossing them, swinging seamlessly between bits and riffs in a display of vocal trapeze. The intensity of his focus was fire and brimstone. He commanded attention like a preacher at a pulpit, and the men listened to his words like they might save their souls. Although he wasn't as quick as he was in his prime, his crowd work remained tenacious, rapid fire. All he saw were targets, bobbing from one man to the next and weaving in callbacks, operating at a high speed in multiple sectors, an expert spinning plates. He made it look easy, because for him, it was.
This place is like my omelets. Whites only. Sandals, huh? Are you married, sir? You are? Does your wife know you're gay? Those are some tight dungarees, brother. I can see you're circumcised. Jesus, I think it winked at me. Were you a Marine, sir? I thought so. Your ball sack matches your haircut, high and tight.
In the trenches, blunt effectiveness trumped clever. These men weren't here to think. Nothing he said was profound. He did what worked. He dealt in volume and velocity, worked at a fevered pace. boom, boom, boom. He knew the secret. Laughter regrets its own inertia, and like anything temporary, it yearns for perpetuity. Like a basketball spun on a fingertip, once he had them going, it was only a matter of maintaining momentum. The feeling was undeniable. Total domination. He was ruthless, precise, unpredictable. His eyes glimmered, full of blue flames. I am trying to kill you. I have your lives in my hands. Around the 40-minute mark, Billy Ray paused for a sip of beer while the men wheezed the dry rattle of dissipating mirth. To Billy Ray, they sounded like victory, conquest. He granted them respite. They breathed with his permission. It didn't matter what he said anymore. These men were subservient, eager slaves to the sounds he made. His voice was Pavlovian. A pattern had been established. He talked, they laughed. Enough. It was time to bring it home. Billy Ray adjusted his pants and turned to face the groom. Well, gentlemen, this has been fun, but let's not forget why we're here. How about a round of applause for the man of the hour? On cue, the men hooted like primates. Tommy, where are you? There he is. Tommy, sweet Tommy. You're getting married tomorrow. How you feeling? The groom raised a can of beer. I'm feeling drunk. Billy Ray smiled. As you should. Look, let me ask you something. Do you hate blowjobs?
No.
Then why are you getting married? Billy Ray swatted a fly circling his head. How old are you, son?
I'll be 30 next month.
30? God damn. I've got pubes older than you. Look at you. Handsome, fit. You got a job?
I supervise a road crew.
So you make good money?
I do just fine.
Well, don't brag about it too much. These guys are going to up your dues. Billy Ray gathered the mic cord and walked to the edge of the stage, tingling with a pleasant delirium. Sweat dripped off his chin, staining his clothes and spreading in dark patches under his arms and down the center of his back, forming crescents beneath his breasts. He was lightheaded, his senses heightened. He felt as if he could hear sounds before they happened, as if they were creations of his will. Only he knew what came next, and this knowledge gave him power. Tommy, listen to me. As a happily divorced man, let me give you some advice from the bottom of my heart. Run. Go. Save yourself. Go while you still have time. It's not too late. I know a guy who works in witness protection. He'll set you up with a whole new identity, a new life. There's the door. Here's my keys. He fished the ring of car keys from his pocket and tossed them to the young man. Red Corolla parked out front. It's a rental. Don't worry. I'll report it as stolen. You can be in Mexico by sunup. Hell, I'll carry you across the border like a camel if I have to. Border Patrol would understand. They'd probably give us police escort to the whorehouse. Just go, go, go! A flash of dire panic cracked the groom's face while the rest of the men laughed. Billy Ray understood the look. The young man wasn't sure if he was joking. It's funny because it's true and other deceptions. The most human part of Schaefer wished he could drop the act, bring the betrothed close and whisper, "Yes, I'm serious. This is the end of you, man." But that wasn't funny. And Billy Ray only said what was funny. So instead he lied. Jesus, son, I'm fucking with you. Did you see his face? He was thinking about it. He was trying to remember his high school Spanish. I'm kidding. Tommy, relax. You've got nothing to worry about. Congratulations. I wish you and your bride nothing but the best. Here's to you. Let's hear it for him, fellas. The crowd, a rolling tide, roared their felicitation. You dumb shits, he thought. Billy Ray stared. How could they allow themselves to be gulled by such cheap manipulation? He loathed their hope, but he allowed their celebrants, their crescendo. Only a fool shunned a free applause break. Billy Ray drank his beer, standing firm in the eye of the storm, dreading the moment the adulation ceased and he had to speak again. He decided to close on an old story he hadn't told in some time. A longer version of the story appeared as the final track on his second comedy album, White Collar / Redneck, a record that reached number 7 on the Billboard spoken word chart. The anecdote detailed the day he and his son visited his father's deathbed. In the joke, he and his son were together and laughing. Outside of the joke, they hadn't talked in years. Unlike most stories comedians told, the events he related actually occurred. The hospice did reek of death, like urine, Lysol, and held in tears. When they entered the room, his father was asleep, as was his mother. Him, in his adjustable bed, her, in the reclining chair she lived in for the long 3 months it took her husband to die. Both he and his son had seen his father's erect penis, poking out of his boxer shorts like a startled ostrich. And the ending was word for word accurate. He and his son did laugh hard enough to wake up his mother, and her response upon waking up was her crowning contribution to the world of humor. So there we are. We're dying. Well, actually, they're dying. We're laughing, and the nurse is confused. And that's when my mother wakes up and sees us, and she says, Billy Ray, Jeremiah, what's so funny? My son, he's an honest kid. So he looked at his grandmother and told her the truth. Well, Granny, I'm sorry to wake you up, but Grandpa's got a boner, and me and Dad are laughing at it. Now, my mother, she isn't exactly what you call a cut-up, but on that day, she said the funniest thing she ever said. Standing motionless, behind the microphone in the stand, Billy Ray swept the room with his eyes, reading the faces of the supplicants assembled. He took his time, scanning slowly, increasing the force of the silence. After saying so much, now he said nothing. The tension begged to be relieved. Anticipation impregnated the room. Through a break in the curtains, he saw the world beyond the window had fallen to complete abject black. For all he knew, this was all that was left. He waited a beat longer, listening to an internal clock that ticked in his blood. At precisely the correct moment, he opened his mouth, licked his lips, and pulled the pin. My mother said, and I swear to God, she said, "Oh, that's okay, honey. I've been laughing at it for 80 years. The adamance of their praise was deafening. He had to yell to be heard. "I've been Billy Ray Schaefer. I've got T-shirts for sale." He found himself waving with both hands like Nixon as men rose to their feet. "Now what do you say we get the girls back out here?" The applause devolved into grunting. The night slipped into decay. They were kind with the liquor. He became automatic. Behind his eyes was a scraped out void, bleached by the poison that powdered his machine. His head rolled on his neck like it was rested on ball bearings as he lurched about as if hung on strings, a marionette piloted by crippled hands. He was an amoeba. He operated with a primal understanding, responding to the simple stimuli in aborted sentences. His eyes barely open, his memory perforated. He continually dissolved. Still, he drank. Upside down, the small-breasted woman stood on her hands, straddled his head, and butted his chin with her pubis. He clenched his teeth. Her groin was sharp, and the thrusting hurt his jaw. But he bore it without complaint. In fact, he said nothing. He was afraid if he opened his mouth, he might bite off his tongue. He couldn't see the other woman, the one he wanted. But he could hear the scrape of her voice as she negotiated with the other man. Her voice was too coarse to whisper.
100 for that, she told the man. 200 for both.
They introduced themselves, but Billy Ray forgot. Names didn't matter. In his head, he referred to them as the small one and the big one. The small one was the girl currently tapping his chin flat. The material of her thin panties was chafing him raw. Her face was long and thin, dominated by her eyes, which were round and lovely, like twin almonds made of glass, and encircled in rings of sunken blue-gray. Her cheekbones stuck out like awnings. She had a habit of chewing her lip in the side of her mouth, a flirty affection that reminded Billy Ray of a raccoon. Her body was jagged, like she was made of elbows, edged where most women were supple and displeasing to touch. She smelled like moss. The big one was the softer of the two and the subject of Billy Ray's booze-soaked libido, while her face, with its weak mouth and small, upturned nose and brown, beady eyes set too close together, was rodential. Her ample body was as wide at the shoulders as it was at the hip. Not fat by any means, but sturdy, built of curves, both rounded and heaped. Her novelty proportions raised a jiggly, juvenile kind of lust in him. By way of introduction, Billy Ray told her he wanted to put a saddle on her and play Lone Ranger. She accused him of being the comedian, and he said no. He owned a circus, and he was trying to fill a sword-swallowing position. This caused her face to wink even more squirrelish. He couldn't tell, but he thought it was her version of a smile. Sure enough, she extended her hand, and he took it, and she led him this way to the back room where her and the small woman had been stationed all night. She sat him down, but before she could offer her terms, her counterpart started bouncing on his lap. The room was windowless and lit by two desk lamps positioned on the floor, pointing at two plush recliners set back to back. The chair she had him pinned against smelled of men grown old in the country, the stink of barn jackets, scotch and hay, manure and sweat. This place reminded Billy Ray of the mudroom in his childhood home where his father kept his boots, the forgotten room where Ollie Schaefer smoked his hand-rolled cigarettes and took his coffee on frigid mornings while the snow swirled outside in blinding mosaics. Both rooms were sparsely appointed, decorated in the utilitarian style of rural people. A map of Colorado pinned to the wall was the only decoration, besides an empty coat rack in one corner and a card table supporting stacks of red plastic cups, a few bottles of liquor, and a plastic Tupperware full of ice. Underneath the table, a CD player pumped modern country into the stale air. Unlike the main room, the antechamber was charmless and uninviting. Even with the skinny woman's sex threatening to break his nose, Billy Ray felt like a detainee, as if any second he was about to be subjected to an interrogation. It was guilty in here. After one final jab to his chin, the skinny woman dropped her feet back down to the floor and pulled her panties to the side so that Billy Ray could see directly into the puckered pink hole in the center of her ass.
"You're looking at $200, cowboy,"
she said, looking up between her legs.
"Three without a rubber."
She slapped her cheeks with her hands, then stood up and faced him. She wore nothing besides the sheer panties. Topless, her tiny breasts looked like nippled shoulder blades. Her head was near shaved, clipped with a zero or a one guard to a fine brown buzz. The haircut did her face no favors. In the wrong light, her femininity abandoned, and she became a shirtless boy with maternal hips. "Well," she said, running her palms down her torso. She drugged the tip of her tongue the circumference of her glossed mouth.
"You want a party, baby?"
"Have to save my money," he said. "Need an operation." Her face sagged, eyes wide.
"Oh, poor thing."
"Doctor says I need a penis shortening. Very expensive." The other man said something to the big woman that made her laugh. Billy Ray couldn't make it out, but he knew in this room, at this time, whatever he said was desperate.
"You're funny,"
the small one said. "I want to fuck your mouth." The girl whistled.
"50 up front."
Billy Ray's hand went to his wallet, but he stopped. He pointed towards the ground and stirred his finger. "Spin around first. I need to check you for ticks." As she gyrated in weak circles, Billy Ray made a catalog of the indelible designs inked into different pieces of her. A blackbird, he judged as a crow, was drawn permanently on the blanched skin stretched tight across her ribcage. The bird held her left nipple in its beak. Empty black stars were tattooed on the top of her shoulders and in the hollow of her lower back, written like a memory, the words "baby girl." "Who does your tattoos?"
"What?"
"Who does your tattoos?"
"My brother."
Bracing herself with her hands on his knees, she snapped forward like a snake and rubbed her face on the crotch of his pants. The sudden attack to his groin caused Billy Ray to flinch, but he relaxed as she nuzzled his lap with her forehead. He could feel her skull through his pants. "Careful now," said Billy Ray. "Don't put your eye out." She laughed into his groin as he snuck his fingers under the elastic of her thong. Behind him, the other man moaned. Billy Ray's solicitor stood up and posed with her hands on her waist. She was younger than the other woman, but haggard, feeble. Her body was too narrow to house the organs that it sustained. The longer he looked at her, the less of her he saw. Billy Ray figured he outweighed her 3-1. She was frail, incapable of protecting herself. Anyone could take anything from her. Something was eating her up. She was almost gone. "How old are you?" he asked. She knelt in front of him and spread his knees apart with her hands.
"Younger than you."
Her hand found his zipper. He folded the 50, tented it, and placed it atop her head like a paper hat. She told him to lie back. He shut his eyes. After 10 minutes, she stopped and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
"You want to try something else? You're not even..."
"I'm drunk."
"I can tell."
"Keep trying."
"I've got other money to make."
"I'm close." The girl returned to her task, but several more fruitless minutes, he shoved her head back and zipped himself away. "Nope. Nope. Nope. Nope."
"It's okay."
"They got me drunk." The girl picked a half-burnt cigarette butt from the ashtray on the card table.
"It's a party," she said, lighting the refry. "We're having fun."
Billy Ray patted himself down for cigarettes and found none. "Can I have some of that?" She gave him the cigarette. "I gotta straighten out."
"We all do."
He sat up in the chair. "Can you get stuff?"
"What stuff?"
The burning cherry floated between them like a comet as they passed the cigarette in the low light. "White."
"You think you need that?"
"I'll give you some." Using the chair for support, she stood up and retrieved a soft pack of Salems from a purse hanging on the coat rack.
"How much?"
"A ball." She lit her cigarette and shook the match dead.
"Are you asking or telling?"
"A ball," he said. Pensive, doing math in her head, the girl searched his face for a moment until she found whatever it was she needed.
"I'll see what I can do. Wait here."
She opened the door, allowing a wedge of light and sound to pierce the room, stepped into it, and was gone. Foregoing a cup, Billy Ray took a bottle of dark liquor from the card table and sat back down and waited. The repetitive, wet, plunging sound rising from the chair behind him gave the room a unique tempo. I'm formless thoughts rolled in his head like blank balls in a hopper. What? Why? His body ached for sleep. Where do I? Why? The bottle rose. The liquor tasted like his breath. When Billy Ray woke up, he thought he was dead. He was shaking him, the squat man he took for the devil. His hands were heavy on him. He understood they were there to prevent him from floating up to heaven. The man's fingers, stout and strong, dug into Billy Ray's shoulder. His face was shaped like a dinner plate. His head dug in necklace to his compressed body. The eyes dark and bored into his pink flesh like hot coals in snow. Seeing him, this fiend claiming his body, Billy Ray was compelled to scream. The women jumped back. The man laughed and let go. By not levitating, Billy Ray understood he was alive after all.
"Easy, big boy,"
the large woman said. Her puffy nipples stood out alert against the material of her robe.
"Easy now."
In the corner of the room, the skinny girl alternated between dragging a cigarette and chewing the nail of her thumb. Smoke curled in wisps.
"Wake up and smell the roses," the man said, dangling a sandwich bag before Billy Ray's face.
Tied off in a corner of the bag, a turnip-sized lump of white powder hung pendulant. He swung the lump back and forth in front of Billy Ray's eyes like a television hypnotist. Billy Ray, understanding his role, reset himself in the chair. His mouth began to salivate. He looked at the skinny girl and she nodded. Billy Ray asked for a cigarette. She complied. Next to her, the big woman leaned against the door, her arms crossed.
"Make it quick, Travis. We need the room."
"Oh, I'm quick,"
the man pinched her chin with his thumb.
"You know that."
He bent forward, hands on his knees, putting his face close to Billy Ray's.
"How you doing there, sailor? Need a light? Give him a light, Henrietta."
The skinny girl leaned forward to join the flame of her bick to the end of the cigarette poked between Billy Ray's lips. Once it was lit, the man smacked her ass, raising her onto the balls of her.
"Henrietta here tells me you're looking for something extra,"
he spoke slowly, decisive, his voice twanging through a Dixie lilt. His breath was hot on Billy Ray's face. It smelled like cinnamon gum. "I do. I am. The man unbent. Upright, he was barely taller than Billy Ray sitting down. His top lip raised as he licked his front teeth. Considering Billy Ray, he tucked his hands into his hip pockets, stuck out his belly, and rocked on his heels, appraising the big man as if he were for sale at an auction.
"They tell me you're a comedian."
"Okay.
Is that right?"
"Yes.
I like comedians."
"Okay.
What kind of comedy do you do?"
Billy Ray ashed his cigarette on the arm of the chair. "The funny kind." The man turned to the woman.
"You hear that? The funny kind. That's good. That's funny."
"Donnie said he was funny."
"Well, if Donnie said it..."
The man looked at Billy Ray, sucked his teeth.
"Do you know Rodney Carrington? I seen him in Phoenix once. He didn't swear one time. I was goddamn..."
"Do you swear?" A knock on the door from the other room interrupted his questioning. The big woman cracked the door, spilling a slash of light onto her face.
"I know," she said out of the door. "Just a minute, I promise."
She shut the door with her shoulder and turned back to the man.
"Travis?"
Her exhausted patience plain.
"Come on." "I was just trying to pick his brain."
"Look at him," she said. "There ain't no brain to pick."
The man pulled the chunk of cocaine out of his pocket and handed it to the skinny girl.
"The boys out front said he was funny something fierce. Don't look so funny now. Why don't you tell us a joke?"
"Why don't you suck my dick?"
"Henry said she tried that already."
The skinny girl untied the plastic knot and returned the open baggie to him.
"Give me your cellophane."
The woman peeled the wrapper off her Salem's and gave it to a man, and he knelt in front of the card table.
"Get some light this way."
The big one picked up a lamp from the floor, cutting the room in half, and held it like a lantern besides the man's work. The shadow of his head became a toad on the wall.
"He said he wants a ball."
The man bit his lip as he measured the half piece of cocaine into the wrapper. He held it up to Billy Ray.
"That look right to you?"
"How much?" The man paused. He looked up at Henrietta. She shrugged.
$150?
Billy Ray counted the bills out on his lap, then recounted them for the man to see. 20, 30, 40, 7, 60, 80, 100, 150. The man tucked the wad into the pocket of his shirt and sealed the top of the cellophane with a lighter before handing it to Billy Ray.
"My work here's done. You happy?"
He leaned in to kiss the big woman, but she turned her head and opened the door.
"Fine,"
he said. Pleasure doing business with you, Mr. Comedian. The man turned to the skinny girl. I'll be out front.
Some of that's mine.
We'll see. The big woman kicked the leg of Billy Ray's chair. Hey, you too. She snapped her fingers, holding the door open.
Out.
She kicked the chair again. Let's go. Three men filed past Billy Ray as he stumbled out of the door. Before the door shut, he heard the big woman say,
Sorry about that, fellas. He was just telling us a joke.
The party crowd had thinned considerably, boiled down to stragglers. The remaining men sat and talked in gathers of threes and fours, their faces slack and vacant, leaned back in their metal chairs with their legs spread wide and shirts untucked, a few of them shoeless and stockinged feet, their tall riding boots removed and set in paired vigils next to crushed beer cans and half-eaten hot dogs and torn bags of store-brand potato chips and empty tins of sardines. In the corner, a man curled around a crock pot, slept on the ground using a flag for a pillow. No one noticed Billy Ray collect his suitcase and go. The hallway back to the bar seemed much longer than before. He barreled down the passage, knocking frames off the wall, eager to be alone with the cocaine. The need for the powder was an awful eating feeling, a gnawing he experienced in the radicals of his teeth and the cores of his bones. It made his hands sweat, this fantastic compulsion. It was all he needed and all there was. The bartender put down his rag when the big man entered the room.
Take it off, Mr. Schaefer?
Billy Ray ignored him. The barman tried again to get his attention, but Billy Ray walked straight into the night. A layer of fresh snow blanketed the world. He stopped to let his eyes adjust, coughing on the cold air. The untouched snowfall shimmered like powdered diamonds, flecked through sparks of purple and blue. The suitcase carved tracks in the white. At the car, he collapsed the bag's telescoping handle and tossed the case in the back seat. The vehicle sputtered to a start and he sat behind the wheel, shaking and watching his visible exhalations fog the rearview mirror. A chrysalis of frost coated the windshield. It felt like he was encased in amber. Early in their marriage, when Olivia worked the sunrise shift at the hospital, he drove her to work when he could, avoiding the bus and allowing her an extra 40 minutes of sleep. He woke up at 5, 15 minutes before his wife, often still drunk and on scant hours of sleep, to start a pot of coffee and warm up the Buick. On the cold mornings, when the light was missed and the day yet solidified, he sat in the driver's seat smoking cigarettes and towing the gas into the Le Sabre, goosing it until the defrost came on and it melted away the verglas. Sitting in the frigid car reminded him of those crisp mornings, groggy and hungover, but proud to be of service to the woman he loved. She'd come out with her steaming coffee and her Carhartt jacket sipped up to her ears and talked the entire ride, filling his head with hospital gossip involving the names of co-workers he pretended to know and taking dainty sips from her mug and pointing at buildings she liked and him driving with his hand on her thigh and taking the speed bumps, slow as not to spill her coffee, driving until they arrived finally at the ER with its glass facade gleaming in the light of the new day sun and her kissing him goodbye, saying, I love you, baby. Saying, thank you, my love. Sitting here fighting hiccups and blowing heat into his hands, he remembered those mornings long ago when he had a purpose and a reason. This was like that, only completely different. A pounding on the roof of the car ended his reminiscence. Obscured by the rime of frost, a stooped figure called to him from outside the glass, the shape of words undecipherable and dampened by the door. Billy Ray wondered if this was real or yet another failing of his grasp on things. But the form tapped on the glass, asserting its legitimacy. What? Asked Billy Ray. He tried the window crank, but the glass, froze stuck to the door frame, refused to lower. He leaned hard on the crank, breaking the hold of the frost, and through the gap he saw the upper portion of the barman's face.
You forgot your dinner.
The bartender held up a white styrofoam box.
The steak.
Oh. He forced the lever down further to allow the box passage. Cody or Clark, something with a C. Thanks, he said.
No problem.
Cody or Clark leaned in close to the crank, blowing his breath into the car.
This weather sure came out of nowhere.
He glanced at the road, furrowed his brow.
Hell of a night to be driving. Is this front-wheel drive?
Billy Ray had no idea.
There's a cab service in town.
He trailed off, leaving space for a conclusion to be made. But Billy Ray's eyes registered no change or understanding. The barman cleared his throat.
We could charge it to the club, have them bring you back out tomorrow for the car.
Billy Ray didn't know what was expected of him in this moment. He grasped the words without comprehending the message. Driving was one of the few skills he had. He drank, he smoked, he drove. Without the car, he was trapped, and that wouldn't do. He opened his wallet and slipped $5 out the slot, hoping that's what this was about. But the man refused the bill.
No, Mr. Schaefer.
The barman grabbed a hold of the windows as if to hold the car in place.
You sure took down a lot of Blue Label tonight.
He cocked his head and pitched his eyebrows.
I'd certainly feel better if...
Billy Ray rolled up the window, nearly clipping the tip of the barman's fingers. He flipped the windshield wipers and the frost moved away in a wet sheet. Cleared, Billy Ray pulled the gear selector, missing reverse by one click, and stomped the accelerator. The man jumped back as the fresh snow caught the rear tires, preventing their traction, snaking the car left, then right, before the tread caught the asphalt and the car plowed across an elevated island of grass, smashing grill first into the trunk of a conifer. The seams of the airbag sliced his face, breaking his nose, snapping his head back into the headrest, an explosion of stark white, drifting, lost. He disappeared for a while.
Mr. Schaefer? Mr. Billy Ray?
He was on the ground looking up at the sky. Snowflakes landed on his face and became pink water on his skin. From the blood, steam rose.
You're all cut up, Mr. Billy Ray.
The barman knelt beside him in the snow, his hands hovering above the body, afraid to touch anymore. The collision compressed the front of the car. Smoke escaped the hood, accompanied by the bleeding of the smashed horn. The noise called the last Shriners outside to gawk at his disaster. In their tiny red hats against the serene white, made small by the distance, they looked like elves, and he understood them as such. In and out. Black to white to black again. Hands on, hands off. A voice squeezed his feet, asking, "Can you feel that? How about this?" Red and blue lights purpling in the snow. He heard voices. I told him. I swear I did. Then he was lifted and delivered into a room where plastic snakes were inserted into his face. Hold still. The room moved under him. In and out. In and out. In. Out. He woke up flanked by machines of rectangular design. Their monitors told a story. Green lines moved inside of them, numbers in red. He was beeping. Tubes stung the back of his hands, either delivering blood or stealing it. There was no way to tell. Maybe I am dead, he thought. Or maybe I was never alive.
Hey there, this is Adam Caton Holland, and I am doing the Friday chapter of Running the Light by Sam Talent. Friday. The doctor never looked up from his clipboard. We ran a CAT scan. No signs of brain trauma, no bruising, no bleeds, minor lacerations, no stitches necessary. Your nose is broken, but you knew that. You should be out of here today. Billy Ray sipped apple juice from a box dwarfed miniature in his hands. Shards of light wormed through the blinds, building a hopscotch on the gray ceiling. Looking up from his back, he felt upside down. The doctor seemed put out. He was older than his patient. He spoke in a monotone dirge, the way someone sounds recounting a story they've told too much. He looked like it had been years since he'd got enough sleep. Vines of red veins grew out of the sides of his nose and spread across his cheeks in the pattern of broken glass, up into the heavy bags that pillowed his eyes. A lifetime of familiarity with the persistence of death warped his face, but his hands, pristine tools, appeared to be 30 years younger than the rest of him. Mr. Schaefer, the doctor removed his glasses and looked up from his chart. We ran your blood work. When was the last time you've seen a medical professional? Billy Ray cleared his throat. The last time I had insurance. His voice came out flat beneath his squashed nose. And when was that? I quit paying SAG in 99. The doctor looked above his head, doing the math. So, 18 years? It was 99. The doctor sat back in his chair and crossed his legs. Do you have a history of hypertension in your family? My daddy had fast blood. Is he alive? Nope. How did he pass? Heart attack on his combine. And at what age did he pass? 51. He was born on the same day. And your mother? She died too. How? I'm not sure. My sister found her. Billy Ray straightened up in the bed. Fucked her up. How old was she? My sister? Your mother. 55, 6? What's with the question, Sawbones? The doctor removed a pen from behind his ear and wrote something on the clipboard. Mr. Schaefer, at the time of your intake, your blood pressure was 170 over 02. From a medical standpoint, those are worrisome numbers. Billy Ray looked past the doctor to the hallway behind him. Out there, two women in sky blue smocks laughed across a water cooler. One of them covered her face, nodding emphatically as the other gripped her shoulder. He wondered what was so funny. The doctor continued. Are you a smoker? Billy Ray nodded. And how often do you drink? When I'm working. And how often do you work? Every day I can. The doctor jotted. What about the cocaine? At this, Billy Ray's brow caved. What? Your workup showed, the doctor said, flipping to another piece of paper, a level of 0.8 milligrams of cocaine per liter of blood. That indicates either a sustained period of use or one hell of a night. The doctor leveled his eyes. I understand you're a comedian, Mr. Schaefer? That's what they tell me. He wanted another juice boxer, preferably something stronger. That must be a lot of pressure. You're a doctor. My wife was a nurse. That's a lot of pressure. The doctor uncrossed his legs and planted his feet on the floor. By the angle of light through the blinds, Billy Ray knew it was early morning. They must have kept him here all night. Can I get another juice? Mr. Schaefer, you're putting a lot of years on your heart. Apple's fine, or grape if you got it. I don't think you're hearing what I'm saying. No, I heard you. You said I could get out of here today. The doctor tucked the pen behind his ear and stood up. He was taller than Billy Ray assumed, long in the leg. He put his glasses back on. You're on an unreckonable path, sir. Did I sleep through breakfast? The doctor sighed and returned the chart to the end of the bed, and Billy Ray shut his eyes until he heard the doctor leave. Alone, he fell into a fitful sleep. In his dream, he stood under a waterfall. The water ran over his face in a sheet, pounding him. He tried to move, but the water was too strong. When he woke up, his face was warm and sticky, and his pillow was wet with blood. Upon his discharge, he bought a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt from the gift shop and changed out of his blood-stained clothes in the bathroom in the lobby. He filled the prescription they gave him at the on-site pharmacy and called the rental car company from a phone at the front desk. Fully insured with Diamond Club status, the operator said no problem when he told them where to collect the Corolla and happily transferred him to their franchise in Pueblo, where he reserved another car. He hung up, called a cab, and stepped outside to smoke a cigarette. He bummed off a nurse. A sharp wind slashed the afternoon, screaming across the bright day and whipping the leaves off the trees. On the lawn, the thin snow had hardened overnight into a dirty gray crust. Billy Ray hid from the cold in the high sunlight drenching the hospital's eastern wall, flattening his body against the lee to avoid the clawing wind. When the cigarette was gone, he consulted the ashtray built into the top of the trash can, but the snowmelt had ruined the butts. He sat on the curb and stared at the sun. A corrosive anxiety rose in his breast. At any moment, he expected to be accosted by deputies holding handcuffs, open and hungry for his wrists. The way he understood it, the presence of an ambulance meant that the police were informed automatically. Didn't they share the same scanners? The men at the club were powerful, but they had no incentive to cover for him. He didn't even get to eat the steak. In 1987, up in Maine where the sun goes down at 3 in the afternoon, he'd been hauled in for a DUI. But using a combination of name-dropping, folksiness, and anti-Canadian humor, he managed to charm not only his arresting officer, but the entire sheriff's office, and they released him in the morning scot-free after gathering around for a Polaroid. A deputy even gave him a ride back to his car. This wouldn't be like that. You should never go back to the well. He was different, then and now. Back then, he was almost famous. Today, according to the doctor, he was almost dead. All through the morning, he listened for the sound of boots on the tile, waiting for that blue uniform to knock on the door and say, Billy Ray Schaefer, you're coming with me. But the blue uniform never came, and now he sat outside away from the entrance with his fingers crossed, praying to whatever wasn't cold and dead that the next car to turn into the hospital complex was a yellow taxi and not a black and white. A DUI would ruin him, but most pressing, the show in Denver started at 7. He was running out of time. Eventually, a black sedan turned off the country road into the hospital entrance. As the car approached, Billy Ray's heartbeat staccatoed as he prepared to disappear into the thicket of black trees behind the hospital at the first sign of law. The car seemed civilian. No cherries, no bull bar, no government plates, and the driver was paunchy and disheveled. It was the words painted in white on the passenger door that finally convinced him. Southern Colorado Taxi Co. He relaxed. Hell yes, he said, flagging the driver. He was in the back seat before the car reached a full stop. The cabbie was brown and fat, his eyes in the rearview red crescents. In the corner of his mouth, a nub of unlit cigar muddled his words. You Daniel? Sure am. Where to? The cab smelled like wet socks. How much to Pueblo? Pueblo's a ways, bud. How much? Cash or card? cash. The cigarette spun as the driver mulled. I'll do it for 80 if it's cash. Billy Ray counted the bills and laid them on the driver's shoulder. I'll throw in some extra if you're fast. We got to make one stop first. Billy Ray gave the man the address of the golf course and slunk down in the seat, but his size made concealment an impossibility. Lowering, his face appeared in the driver's side mirror. He looked bad. In the middle of his nose was a rotten potato. A crooked black tuber stuck in the center of a violent bruise under a forehead thatched with strips of white adhesive bandage. Smiling hurt. Billy Ray dug two Valium out of the pocket in his wallet, chewed them down, and swallowed them dry. The car lurched as the driver geared to drive. The world passing outside of the car was rendered in a weak fidelity, grainy, flat, monochromatic. Banks of plowed snow piled in 2-foot drifts lined the sides of the road, the mounds built taller where the wind was most prevalent. Vehicles kicked the snowmelt from their back tires and rooster tails. An opaque sky hid the sun from the earth. The taxi accelerated around a 6-wheeled pickup hauling a long metal horse trailer, and Billy Ray made eye contact with one of the horses through the slats. The big animal's eyes were rheumy, yellowed like the pages of an old book. They looked defeated, like they'd seen enough, the eyes of a wild thing captured. Better you than me. What's that, bud? Said the driver. I was talking to the horse, said Billy Ray. The golf course was closer to town than Billy Ray remembered. He told the driver to pull up to the security booth, and he rolled down his window. The security guard leaned his top half out of the booth, his legs below him not visible. He looked like a massive sock puppet. Howdy there. Hey, howdy. I was the comedian last night. What's your name? Schaefer. The security guard popped back in the booth and consulted a computer screen. He shook his head. I don't have a Schaefer on my list. I was the one who crashed the car. Oh. I gotta get some stuff before the tow comes. I heard about you. I bet. Must have been a hell of a party. The gate arm lifted and the cab pulled up the drive into the parking lot, and Billy Ray directed the driver to park next to the squash Corolla. Pop the trunk, would you? He lugged his suitcases from the wreck to the taxi before sweeping the interior. Loose belongings were shoved into a ruck he reserved for dirty clothes. Trash he collected in plastic grocery bags, getting under the seats, careful not to leave behind any evidence of criminality in case the rental company investigated the car. It was remarkable how much detritus he generated in just 3 days. 2 bags full of fast food wrappers and styrofoam cartons and cigarette boxes and paper cups and napkins and crushed beer cans and water bottles and condiment packets left unused. Hundreds of dollars turned into excrement, pounds of trash, the evidence of his life. Before he shut the door, he left the keys in the visor as he'd been instructed by the rental agency. And as he always did when returning a car, he rolled down the windows to air out the stink of stale smoke, lest he incur a fine. He shut the trunk and kicked the mud off his boots and returned to the taxi. Don't worry, I won't ask, said the driver. The car began to move. On the radio, 2 men with similar rancorous voices yelled about war and the economy and oil. The driver increased the volume as they pulled onto the main highway. Let me know if you want me to change the radio. Billy told him it was fine. Good. You don't like music? I like to hear what people have to say. So you're talk radio only. If I'm in the car, it's on. You ever listen to Phil Hendry? That's the guy that does them voices? Yep. He's pretty funny sometimes. He's a genius. From the wreck, Billy Ray had salvaged half a pack of cigarettes. You mind if I smoke in here? I don't mind if you don't mind. Driver opened the glove box and retrieved a fresh cigar the same color as the pads of his fingers. He put the cigar in his mouth and chomped the head and spat the decapitated nub out the window. You like Coast to Coast? Said Schaefer, already sucking on a Winston. When I drive at night, of course. George Noory is my guy. Holding the wheel steadily with his knees, the cabbie sparked a match, and plumes of rich smoke clouded the car as he puffed the cigar rolling. He's one of the few men that tell the truth. Billy Ray yawned. The pills he swallowed were already caressing his blood, sanding the edges off the bleached afternoon. You believe in all that stuff? What stuff? You know, lizard people, Bigfoot, Kennedy's still alive and lives with Elvis in the center of the earth. I don't not believe in it. Being sure of anything is for fools. I think it's all bullshit, the driver snorted. That's what they want you to think, bud. They want you to believe what they tell you. They want us to dream we are awake. Who's they? The men who own the world. They passed the McDonald's attached to a gas station. The sign out front read, 1 billion people can't be wrong. Billy Ray made a circle in the air with a cigarette. You telling me you think there's a plan for all of this? The driver's voice was leveled, sincere. Top to bottom, we're just pawns, bud. We only see what they show us. We're cogs in their big machine. Are you fucking with me? It's all a hoax. Billy Ray tapped his ashes out the thin slit between the window and the door. Shit, if anyone's in control, they're doing a terrible fucking job. They drove on. The driver was aggressive. He used all the lanes, threading the gaps between the other cars and passing on the right. Once he cut off a semi and the trucker blew his horn, but Billy Ray didn't notice. After so many miles behind the wheel, there was a novelty to the back seat. He stared out the window and smoked as the men on the radio answered calls from exasperated people. Long-time listeners, first-time callers, watching Highway 50 sweep past the early winter landscape, past the empty fields of frostbit alfalfa and browned acres of indeterminate growth, and the horses in their blankets and blinders and the cattle behind barbed wire fences, gathering in groupings 100 head deep to share their body heat against the wind. Driving under the begging fast food neon and the green signs detailing the distances to cities and the austere black billboards warning Jesus was coming, repent, repent. The roadway curved to accommodate the footprints of the mountain, the ground pitching gradually away from the car until it met the sheer slabs of ever-rising earth. The mountains, tremendous, their peaks frosted with snow that would not melt for months, were too big to see all at once. Billy Ray cataloged their individual aspects and attempted to piece them together in his mind's eye, but he was unable to build the image as the pills coated his brain in a warm shellac of beautiful nothingness. His body felt unattached to itself. Every few miles, road signs warned, "Beware of falling rock." After the third sign, Billy Ray chuckled to himself. "Beware of falling rock," he said. "A lot of good that's going to do you, huh? Did you hear about Jeff?" "No, what happened?" "Oh, he was driving on 25 and a boulder came out of nowhere and crushed his car." "What a shame. If he had only read the signs." The tube of fat ringing the base of the driver's neck wiggled as he laughed. Billy Ray wrote, "Falling rocks" in his moleskin. Another day at the office. In Pueblo, the driver asked him where to, and Billy Ray gave him the address of the rental car lot. "I don't know the streets up here," the driver said. "Put it in Google." "I don't fuck with GPS. They don't need to know where I am. Put it in your phone." Billy Ray pulled the two pieces of his phone from his pocket. "Oh," the driver said. The driver pulled into a gas station, and Billy Ray went in to ask directions. The cashier apologized. He had no idea. He thought it was by the airport, but the second attendant gave them detailed directions. "By the airport," he scoffed. "What a dumbass." The directions were precise, and they found the lot without incident. Billy Ray tipped the cabbie an extra 10, then, as an afterthought, dropped two volumes into his palm, changing the man effusive. "Shit, bud, good looking." And the two men shook hands and gave dap. "Drive safe," Billy Ray said as he bumped the cabbie's fists. "And keep watching the skies." The cabbie snapped his fingers. "Bet. Look out for falling rocks." The rental agent tried not to stare at his face. His rental options were limited, she explained. The weekend rush had cleared most of their stock, leaving him the choice of a tiny Nissan Leaf or a 10 miles per gallon Escalade battleship. He chose the Nissan and reverse engineered the directions back to the highway. From there, he knew the rest of the way. Driving north on I-25 between a convoy of camouflaged military jeeps, a strange, desolate malaise seeped up through the benzo lacuna like oil through dirt. Between here and Wits End, the club in North Denver where he was booked all weekend, lay the first place he and Olivia really ever called home, Colorado Springs. Their tenure only lasted 4 years before she transferred to the hospital in Denver, but the place was the center of his life's greatest happiness. His life would be empty without what transpired in that time span. The memories seemed impossible, phantasmagoria. Before the ugliness and the ruin, there was the constant sweetness of cohabitation in their little condo. The pride she brought him, the sound of her voice, the smell of her and everything, dinner time and date night and the days spent in bed, perfecting the act that created the two little boys whose arrival changed his very definition. Those 4 years were the marrow in the bones of the skeleton of his history. If they made a drug that replicated the essence of that time period, he would shoot it into his jugular until it replaced his blood and killed him. "Hello, old gal," he said to the welcome sign. Due to the artist's mistake, an extra serif on the N in Springs made the letter appear upside down, a fact locals used to bore tourists. He couldn't remember how his old joke went. He slowed down to investigate whether the end had been fixed, but a passing dually truck blew a cloud of diesel exhaust too thick to see through, and immediately he remembered why he liked this place. Unlike Denver, the big city to the north, with its braggadocious sports franchises and overhyped culture, Colorado Springs, home to the Professional Rodeo Hall of Fame and Air Force Academy, was unpretentious and wild, where urban living meets the mountains. The nearness of Pikes Peak encouraged frequent communes with nature. They'd hike picnics up the mountainside, made love in the long shadows spilling off the Garden of the Gods. A recurring excursion involved taking acid at the zoo. He'd never be as funny as a penguin. Despite the direct access to nature, the Springs wasn't all hippy-dippy like Boulder. People still feared God here. Churches were packed on Sundays. The preachers were celebrities. The military presence infected the whole city with an unhealthy respect for the flag, and the grunts on furloughs prevented a man going soft. Billy Ray had found himself in many a last call dust-up with brush-cut cadets eager to field-test the techniques they'd learned in the academy. It reminded him of where he grew up, and he judged it as good a place as any to be young, fearless, dumb, and in love. He'd been back many times since they'd moved, but the Valium had him sentimental. Everything he saw was a sentence on a page in the book of his life. The Mr. Donut, where she confused Krugers with croissants. The Walgreens, where she purchased the pregnancy test that turned into Walker. Crossing Monument Creek, he recalled the golden afternoon when an overzealous goose, hungry for the pretzel in his pocket, chased him off the shallow bank and into the water. That was the hardest she'd ever laughed, Olivia, who was the most beautiful when she laughed. No joke in his arsenal compared. Spasmodic, she fell on the grass, kicking her feet in the air as she cackled up at the sky. It became the story she told at parties, her most treasured anecdote, and in the telling of it, she laughed just as hard as that day in the park, to the point where she was inconsolable and the story was ruined and she couldn't continue. Then he saw it. Without signaling, he shot across three lanes of traffic, barely catching the exit from Mark Dabbling Boulevard. At the end of the exit loomed the red and white building that always reminded him of a carton of milk. Drifter's Burgers, home of the Boysenberry Malt and the most identifiable border between present and past. He parked beneath the canopy of a bulbous cottonwood with leaves gone rusted and ready to shed. Chimes announced his entrance. An eager teenage boy sporting a long ponytail of sandy brown hair greeted him through braces. "Hello, sir. Welcome to Drifter's." The menu was the same. Burgers, french fries, chicken fingers, hot dogs, corn dogs, chili, and Olivia's personal favorite, Frito pie. "Y'all still do boysenberry malts?" "Yes, sir," the boy said, turning to point at the portion of the menu labeled Sweet Dreams. Agony had made a red moonscape of the side of his face. Around his wrist, a hemp necklace dangled with small charms. "We got shakes, too." "Well, I better have one of those." "A shake? No, the malt." "You got it. What size?" Suddenly, he was very hungry. "Large." The boy raised his voice and threw it over his shoulder. "I need a large berry malt. Is that all, sir?" "You like the Frito pie?" "I used to." The boy flicked his head and the ponytail jumped. "I'm a vegetarian now." "Good for you, kid." The boy smiled. "I'll do a cheeseburger. No ketchup, no tomato, extra pickles." "Onions and lettuce, okay?" "Sure, and a Frito pie." Billy Ray paid and sat in a booth, but the table dug into him, bulging his gut onto the formica. So he moved to a table and waited until the boy brought out his food. It was just like he remembered. The fries were well salted and shoestringed, and the beef tasted like griddle, and the malt was yeasty and tart with the fresh berries. Tasting the Frito pie reminded him of Olivia, tired from another 12-hour shift and splayed out on the couch in the living room of their neat apartment, her head on the armrest, her swollen feet kicked up on his lap as she ate her dinner off the ottoman, the most comfortable of all the empires. A splash of blackberry brandy in her malt, watching Cheers or Battle of the Network Stars until she plummeted into a bottomless sleep, at which time, careful not to wake her, Billy Ray would finish whatever she didn't eat and smoke cigarettes and rub her feet, enjoying being close to her and the bond of their simple domesticity, welling with gratitude for his wife and her love of him, staring at her, transfixed on the little miracle that was the rise and fall of her chest, the small noises she made, glad to be pinned under her and staying there for as long as he could, often through the news and Carson. The remembering of those moments made him wish he was dead. He could never explain it to her. He lacked the vocabulary and refused himself the vulnerability, but those were the moments he craved, the gentle, quiet times. It was the intimacy he sought in the parade of anonymous women he used to fall asleep. They were a facsimile, never a substitute, holograms, an empty needle in his arm. They were nothing, and with them he was less. They gave him their bodies, but they could never give him the feeling of home he derived from rubbing Olivia's feet while she softly snored on the other end of the couch. She was the only one he ever wanted. He needed her. She was like his blood. It was all his fault. Every teardrop. Their divorce was a casualty of his spinelessness. I am weak. I say yes. I need more. Now all the more in the world would never be enough. He was too young then and too strung out. Unable to understand what he was looking for was bigger than the physical, bigger than sex. He was looking for her. Because with her, he was not himself. Inside of his marriage, he was able to hide from the man he was, and when it collapsed, he was crushed, buried beneath the rubble of the enormous form of their love, forever doomed to stalk the demolition, haunting and haunted by the wreckage. He ate a few forkfuls of the Frito pie, but it was too much. He had had enough. He ended up throwing it away. As he left, the boy called out to him, "Thanks for coming in, sir. Drift back again soon." He crossed the parking lot and purchased 6 Coors and 40 cigarettes from a liquor store that smelled like burnt hair. He lit a cigarette and smoked it while pressing his face against the top of the car. The cold metal made his face hurt less. His nose sung with a single throbbing note that spread up into the space between his eyes. If he ate more of the pills, he couldn't drink tonight, and he needed to drink. He cracked one of the beers and chugged it and hid the bottle under a bush. As he crawled in the small scar, the springs yawned with compression. He drove north. The headlights on the asphalt looked like the sky. In no hurry, he drove in the right lane, allowing the cars to pass him as he breathed through his mouth, icing his nose with a beer. Pasture land filled in the spaces between towns. The prairie swayed in the breeze like a single organism comprised of raw nerves. The wind whistled through the grass. West of Larkspur, growing out of the wide nothing, Raspberry Butte built a second horizon in the darkness, flat as a coffee table and set with sharp crystal stars. 10 miles further, Castle Rock was an enormous black tooth. Behind it, in the distance, Denver glowed. By the time he reached Denver city limits, 4 of the beers were gone along with 11 of the cigarettes. The city came on slow, manifesting as nothing more than a collection of overpasses and off-ramps, trapped between retaining walls until he passed Broadway and Gates Rubber and the train yards and the corkscrewed 80-foot yellow statue, the Slinky, his wife called it, that marked the end of the creeping suburbs and the beginning of the city proper. Then he was in it, crossing Santa Fe and 6th Avenue, which was a highway itself, passing Mile High Stadium or whatever it was called now, ovoid and roofless and hulking, and across the highway from the dormant roller coasters of Elitch Gardens, where he'd spent long summer days chasing his sons from ride to ride. And behind that, the college Walker attended as a man, and further on, the white-yellow lights of downtown and the new Performing Arts Center and the Platte River, black and smooth, carving out its space in the world. And up the hill, the cash register building, of which he never knew the real name, and Republic Plaza, the gleaming glass tower on which the city hung its hat, and the Capitol building with its dome leafed in gold and built exactly 1 mile above the ocean. And the spotlights on the city and county building, blinking blue and orange for the season. Denver, the queen city of the plains, where his sons were raised and his love had died, where somewhere, among the streets and avenues and the warm little stone houses built to withstand the cold, his family, the flesh and the blood, learned to live lives devoid of him.
An excerpt from High Praise, 30 Years of Comedy Works, a retrospective serialized in the Denver Post.
Roseanne. In Denver, in those days, it was magic every night. We had the best club and the best owner, and everything was funny. That's all I remember. Laughing. And that was all we did. There was enough stage time to go around, but the scene, I hate that word. I hate that word, scene. Andy Warhol and the hippies hung out in scenes, but we were a tribe. Warriors. Comics. Comics are all loners. But at least we had each other to be alone with. We moved between McKelvey's and the Comedy Works and the Brass Rail, and everyone got along for the most part. The guys would get drunk and fight sometimes. Plenty of beer, plenty of blow, and all that ego and testosterone. I had my moments too, but that didn't mean we didn't love each other.
Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. One time at Comedy Works, this yahoo was heckling Rosie, and I could tell she wasn't having it. I walked up and picked him up by the collar, this big hick from the sticks in a cowboy hat and chick kickers, and I kindly escorted him out of the showroom. He tried to swing on me, so I put his head through the door.
Rick Kearns. Dr. Kev worked security for bands when he was younger. Mountain, the Rolling Stones. Him and his brothers were all Golden Gloves, this pack of Irish long hairs. All of them had fists like hams, and they wore a lot of rings. Out of all of them, Kev had the longer fuse, but he was still pretty short. I was there that night he bounced that cowboy, but that's not even the best part of the story. The next day, the guy calls the club. Hi, he says. I was at the show last night, and one of your comics shoved my head through the wall. The club was already nervous about this guy was going to sue or something. So the manager gets on the phone and says, yes, sir, we're very sorry about that. But the guy cuts her off and says, no. I was drunk and out of line. I shouldn't have heckled. The manager is all surprised. She says, well, all right, then why are you calling? And the guy says, well, I had a hat.
Roseanne, I remember I was furious. I didn't need Kevin's help. I was roasting that asshole and killing. I used to love hecklers. You just made fun of them and you didn't have to do your jokes.
Nora Lynch. Me and my husband, Phil Palisol, we used to work the road a lot, so we were at a distance from the real craziness, but whenever we came home, there was always a story or two. What a pack of knuckleheads. I heard once that Billy Shaver beat the hell out of Ollie Joe Prater in the kitchen at McKelvey's for stealing one of his jokes. You know, he made a real mess out of the guy, but no one stopped him because Ollie Joe was notorious for being a thief. He didn't even try to defend himself. While Billy Ray was pounding on him, Ollie Joe kept saying, but I tell it better, but I tell it better.
Billy Ray Shaver. Yeah, he stole it, but it wasn't even that good of a joke. I just didn't like the guy. He was real friendly whenever I had drugs, but when